The third case for oral argument this morning is Burhan versus Dennis Supply Company. For the appellant, Burhan is Mark Meyer Henry, attorney from Sioux Falls. And for Dennis Supply Company, appellee is Melissa Nicholson, attorney from Sioux Falls. Justice Meyer Henry has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Rodney Steele, presiding judge of the Third Judicial Circuit, to sit in her place. Mr. Meyer Henry, you may proceed, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Mayor Nicholson. This case comes from the Minnehaha jury. The jury found that Dennis Supply, the defendant, was negligent, but found that the negligence of Dennis Supply was not the legal cause of the accident. In instruction 23, the circuit court stated that the negligence claim by the plaintiff was that Dennis Supply, Tom DeGroote, was negligent in his operation of the boat of September 12, 1999. Very briefly, what happened here is this was a business-sponsored fishing trip to Lake of the Woods in Ontario. There were a number of people, customers of Dennis Supply, some from Iowa, some from South Dakota, some from Nebraska. They went fishing with a professional guide in the morning. Nothing eventful happened other than they didn't catch their limit. Later on in the afternoon, Tom DeGroote, Tim Burhan, went back out in a 16-foot boat, aluminum boat, with a Yamaha engine with a tiller, operated by a tiller, out onto the lake. They were both thrown out of the boat. The boat continued on. And the boat continued on because Mr. DeGroote didn't have the shutoff switch called a lanyard throughout the trial around his wrist, which would have stopped the engine when the two men fell out. The jury heard evidence of how this all happened, and the end result was they reached that decision. We're here because we think the circuit court made a number of errors, and those errors, cumulative, and some of them independently, were prejudicial. I spent a lot of time on my brief. I hope it's of assistance to the court on what I think are some very substantial issues of tort law in South Dakota. But I want to start with a procedural issue. This case was represented, at least on the defense side, by very capable and good lawyers. They chose to make a motion very late and amend their answer, which had been a denial and an allegation of contributory negligence, and add the defense of assumption of the risk. Judge Sirska allowed that the day before the trial, literally the day before the trial. This was after months and months of discovery and so forth. We had a pretrial order that all motions, substantial motions, were to be in. That was months ago. We had a pretrial, an extensive one, where we had to submit to the court in writing what the issues were and proposed instructions. That was in August, August 28th, as I recall. And so this was not.
But the motion to amend was made like 30 days before the time that it was actually decided.
It was made on the 9th, Your Honor, many months after all discovery was closed. That's true.
And besides that, what difference would it have made if contributory negligence was legitimately in play? It's not that big of a leap to go to defend the assumption of the risk defense.
Well, it is. It is, Judge. With all due respect, assumption of the risk, let's go back and do a little history. Assumption of the risk is a defense created by the judiciary back around 1900. It is not legislative in this state. It was created by our judiciary, this court. And assumption of the risk cancels all duties. If you read the final argument in this case, two-thirds of it is about assumption of the risk. And it has to do with this. Assumption of the risk is a defense in South Dakota that cancels all duty. Now let me go back to fundamental tort law. We should get all the benefits of the finding of negligence in this case. We go to the next step, which is legal or proximate cause. The negligence we claim is this, that the operator of the boat let go of the tiller. The tiller, due to the prop, swung to the right. The boat swung to the right, swung to the left. The boat swung to the right, whereupon the captain of the ship and my client's husband fell out of the water, fell out into the water. We claimed it was negligence to put an operator like Tom DeGroote in charge. We claimed that his letting go of the tiller must have caused him to fall out. And then we said he was also negligent because he didn't use the lanyard. Had the lanyard been used, the boat would have stopped the minute he fell out because it's around his wrist. These two men fell into the water. They were some 200 yards approximately, give or take, from in Lake of the Woods. It's in September. The water was cold. They're dressed in full clothing with rain gear. There was one cushion available. The evidence is conflicting, but Mr. DeGroote, Dennis Supply employee, got that, put it under his chest, paddled to shore, and lived. Our client's husband was a strong swimmer, sportsman. He went for shore and he sank. So giving the plaintiff all due respect to the finding by the jury that the negligence, that there was negligence on the part of the defendant, let's go to legal cause. What was the legal cause of his injuries? The jury found none. If they were negligent in pitching him into the water under all precepts of tort law, that would be the legal cause, subject to defenses. Now, you add in assumption of the risk, Your Honor, on top of that, allowing the other side, and the lateness of the amendment is this. It is our contention that assumption of the risk shouldn't have been given at all. And it's pretty hard to convince a judge with briefs and everything some 24 hours before the case. And we protested throughout trial. I've objected at every stage. The second part is this, Your Honor. An affirmative defense is no different than a complaint. This court, I don't think, sanctions plaintiffs showing up the day before the trial saying, this is a motor vehicle case, but oh, by the way, I'm going to throw a fraud complaint in and I want to amend it. And in this case, by analogy, not even tell the other side what the fraud is. When we were at that hearing, I objected and I inquired, what was the risk assumed? What was the risk assumed? At that time, they said not wearing a life jacket. As you'll read through the transcript, it increased throughout the trial. It became standing up in the boat. It became basically going in a boat. They assumed the risk of an inexperienced operator. I mean, the defense was allowed to expand it. And then the summation of this mistake that began is Judge Cirska absolutely refused to include in the instructions what risk was assumed. Now, you would never charge a jury for a violation of a defendant's duty without putting in your charge to the jury what the claim of negligence is. In this case, the jury could make up any risk they wished under the instructions given by the court and objected to. We don't know. To go back to Judge Zinner's query, because it's important, what was the legal cause? Well, we know why he drowned. He was pitched in the cold water, fully dressed, and he couldn't swim to shore. But they argued, you assume the risk, and in the words of the defense, you can't win if you don't have a life jacket on. Judge Cirska refused to instruct on duty. Is there a duty under South Dakota law to wear a life jacket in a boat? We had testimony from Tony DeShant, that the duty of a person in a boat is not to wear a life jacket all the time, but it is a duty when going from place to place. But we also requested the court to find, and it's an important ruling, I think, that when a business undertakes to make more money by having guests on a hunting or fishing trip and decide to do it themselves, that they should have a duty under South Dakota law to conduct that fishing trip or that hunting trip to the same standards of a professional hunting or fishing guide. And that's good for our industry in South Dakota, and it's good for those guests who come. You shouldn't allow businesses to do things on the cheap.
The court did instruct that the defendant must possess the skill and knowledge normally preserved by members of the fishing guide profession. Isn't that sufficient?
Well, he did. If you'll see how the argument was used, he said, They would have to make a finding, Judge, that they were a professional fishing guide. The jury, if you read that, it's instruction, if I can find the instruction. It says, a fishing guide must exercise the skill and knowledge normally possessed by members of the fishing guide profession. Our proposed instruction was to say that Dennis Supply, the fishing guide, so to speak, in this case, was Alex, the fellow from Canada. They argued, you know, oh, come on, we aren't going to hold, I mean, in this type of tone, we aren't going to hold these good old boys to the standards of a professional fishing guide. We aren't going to make them give a safety lecture and so forth. So it was very important. And this instruction did nothing, because it doesn't say to the jury what the duty is. But to go back to why, I mean, it's clear that our duty here, I think my briefs point out that the instructions are misleading, confusing, and frankly, there shouldn't have been any assumption of risk instructions. I mean, there shouldn't have been, let alone a defense. But did it have some effect on the jury? Did it have some effect? If Dennis Supply was negligent in pitching my client's husband into the water, what other cause could there have been for his drowning?
Well, there was one possible finding was that the decedent had this floating flotation device and threw it to the other person.
Right, that's true.
I found that to be a legal cause of...
But properly instructed, could, that's where I go back to the numerous errors. There is no duty to wear a life jacket or to have, I mean, that was, let me back up. That was their defense under assumption of the risk.
I'm not talking about duty, I'm talking about your legal cause argument.
It's possible, but it's also possible that they found that he didn't have a life jacket on. But the argument throughout final argument that if he would have had a life jacket on, and I think that's more probable, Your Honor, I mean, that he didn't have a life jacket on. It could be the other. We also know that had that been a defense of contributory negligence, you could instruct on that. I mean, but in this case, Judge Sirska refused to instruct on duties. So before you get to legal cause, you got to know what the duties of the respective parties are. And I submit that had some effect on the jury. Had they been told there's no duty to wear a life jacket, even though, and you certainly don't assume the risk. I mean, you have a jury trial. You've all had it. You've all taken part of it as advocates. From the get-go, you start using loosely these words, assumption of the risk. It's like the old example in all the horn books of the fellow that goes out into the moving traffic. The average person says he assumed the risk of getting hit with the cars. And yet the law says he didn't assume the risk. He might have been contributorily negligent. But the effect is some effect on the jury. And throughout this case, it is patently unfair, and it had an effect on the jury, to not allow the plaintiff even to attempt to prevent, this assumption of the risk defense. We submitted a brief, Justice Zinner. We tried to talk to the court about it. But when you never even define the risk, and it was never defined in this case, as I stand here today, all I have are final arguments where I put in the brief, he ticks off not wearing a life jacket. That requires whether he had a duty or not. Standing up in the boat, that's certainly negligence, but it's not assumption of the risk. It's a perfect analogy to running out in the traffic. Assuming a person stands up in a boat, he certainly doesn't forgive any duty of the boat operator, which is assumption of the risk, cancels any duty, doesn't forgive him any duty to take care of his safety. And then he says, the defendant's counsel says at page 68 of volume 4, if you fall out of a boat, there's a risk you'll drown. I mean, does everybody get in the car assume the risk? The other thing is I objected to the instruction, and I'm going to go through this quickly, but we're the only state in the union that allows constructive assumption of the risk. And that's the word constructive. It allowed, and you'll see in the final argument, allowed them to make this argument He knew this. In fact, two of the witnesses they called only testified as to that word constructed. The defense called the father of the decedent to say he was an experienced fisherman and knowledgeable, and then argued to the jury constructive. We are the only state in the union that does not require proof of actual construction, actual knowledge. And there is no stare decisis. I want to make this clear. There is no stare decisis on that part of my appeal, our appeal. There is no stare decisis, nor could I find, and I think I read every case, where assumption of the risk as a duty-canceling defense adopted by this court has ever been challenged.
Let's go back a little bit to the, just to some basic facts. Do you know how deep the water was in the place where they tipped over, where they tipped out of the boat?
If I remember right, and I could be corrected, 18 to 19 feet.
And the temperature of it was?
47 degrees, I believe. Okay. It was like...
So even if there's no duty on the part of a passenger to wear a boat, even though they were traveling someplace, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
If he stands up in a boat when it's raining and the bottom of the boat is slippery and may have caused the boat to tip, which caused him to go out, isn't it an assumption of the risk on his part not to wear a life preserver when the temperature of the water is 40 degrees? I mean, there's accumulation of things there that seem to me, even if he didn't have a duty to wear a life preserver for his own safety, he's assuming the risk of not wearing a life preserver.
All right, and so if that were true, the defense would have to prove that he knew when he stood up, he was going to slip. And he knew when he stood up, he was going to slip and he was going to fall out of the boat.
Well, can he be aware of the risk that if he did stand up and if his feet slipped on the bottom of the boat, that he might fall out, and if he does fall out, he might drown? He doesn't have to know these things. He doesn't have to have them certified. He doesn't have to have them, he doesn't have to know them for sure.
Well, but then that would be this court ruling that the jury's finding that Dennis Supply was negligent is of no import. Because remember what assumption of the risk does. It isn't a technique of negligence law. It's a judge-made theory to deny otherwise negligent parties having to pay. That's the theory. It's not my theory, it's what the commentators say. So what you would have to have is when he stood up intellectually saying, I forgive Tom DeGroote for not wearing the lanyard for his negligence. And there's no way you can prove that. My client was dead. This was exactly what affected the jury, is the ability to confuse the difference between assumption of the risk, which cancels all duty. That is negligence. What you described is exactly the fellow that goes into the busy traffic. He assumes everybody's going to take care of him and not hit him with the car. It might be contributory negligence, but it's not assumption of the risk. He didn't know he was going to fall out. You have to know under assumption of the risk, but you have to know what's going to happen. And knowing you were going to slip and fall out of the boat, you still stood up. And of course, there's no proof of that, and I don't know how you could prove it in this case. But that's the difference. You had to know, if I start to stand up, I'm going to slip, I'm going to fall out of the boat, and Tom DeGroote's going to fall out of the boat, and then we're going to have to swim for shore. That's assumption of the risk.
Mr. Henry, even more fundamentally than that, because assumption of the risk is a duty-canceling defense, and because this jury clearly found a breach of a duty in their answer to the first question, they found that the defendant was negligent. So they found there was a breach of duty. So I don't see how that makes any difference whether assumption of the risk was instructed or not here.
Well, the difference is it allowed the defense to create the atmosphere that if you go on a fishing trip whatever happens, happens.
But the jury found a breach of duty.
I understand that. Then they had to go to the next step. And there's nothing in the record to show any cause of his drowning save for falling out of the boat. Everything else would have to flow down the contributory negligence or whatever. And clearly, these erroneous rulings had an effect on the jury.
Because so you're saying there was no other legal cause? Because there was no other legal cause, that's...
There is no other legal cause. He fell in the water due to the negligence of the defendant. And, of course, as we all know, people talk... The only way you can eliminate legal cause...
You say he fell in the water because of the negligence of the defendant, but how do we know the jury didn't find that he fell? You know, there's some negligence of the defendant, but that's not attaching the lanyard, which doesn't really come into play until after he falls out of the boat.
Well,
so how do we know he didn't fall out of the boat because of his own negligence and because of the bottom of the boat being slippery and because he's standing up in the rain and maybe loses his balance and pitches over?
Because you have to take the findings in the best light to either party. The best light to our side is that you have to assume the jury agreed that it was a sharp movement of the boat and he fell out of the boat into the water. If you take that finding of the jury, I mean, clearly the finding of the jury is questionable, but you fall out into the water, the cause of your drowning is being in the water, period, unless the jury said, well, yes, they were negligent, they pitched him in the water, but the legal cause, and what are these other things? If he wasn't wearing a life preserver, didn't he assume the risk, cancels the duty? And so if this case were to be retried under proper instructions, we wouldn't be talking about assumption of the risk because this isn't an assumption of the risk case. And then the next question is, if you agree with the appellant on that issue, that there is no assumption of the risk in this case, if you analyze it correctly, did it have some effect on the jury? He took two-thirds of his time in final argument. I mean, all of a sudden, if you stand up in a boat, that's assumption of the risk. It might be negligent, but you certainly don't, in effect, say, I'm standing up here, you, the captain of the ship, you don't have any further duty to take care of my safety, because that's what assumption of the risk is. You're okay. You can fall out of the boat. You can do it anything you want, and you're okay. Because assumption of the risk is a powerful hammer.
I think you've answered.
I was just going to say you got about another 5 minutes in on that answer, but you probably better call it quits. We'll hear from you again. Ms. Nicholson, you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. Every issue raised by Tim Burhan, the plaintiff and the appellant, is moot for the very issues that I've sensed that you have presented in questions to Mr. Meyer Henry in his argument. And they're moot for the reason that this jury specifically found the defendant to be negligent, but that his negligence was not the legal cause of the plaintiff's death.
Well, let's get right into it. What is, under the evidence that was presented to the jury, what could the jury have found to be the legal cause, assuming that the defendant was negligent? What other act, other than the act of the defendant?
Okay, I think there are several things. I think, first, Tim Burhan is an experienced boater. He has a cabin, he owns a boat. He stood up in a moving boat when it was slippery, when it was raining. There were life jackets provided on the boat. He chose not to wear the life jacket, having been on the boat for several hours, having the experience as a boater to know that it's more safe to wear a life jacket. He's out of the boat. He has a seat cushion flotation device that he takes and he voluntarily gives up to Tom DeGroat, and voluntarily and consciously makes the decision to not keep it for himself time to grow, it makes it to shore, and Timberhand does not at that point. And I think any of those factors could have been reason for the jury to believe that the defendant's negligence, whatever it may be, because we don't know what or how the jury found Dennis Supply to be negligent.
Should he be punished because he's a good Samaritan?
The issue, though, is what caused his death. And if he chose to do it, if he chose an action, or if there was any type of other, I'm going to go to the jury instructions that were given. The jury instruction on legal cause stated, a legal cause is a cause that produces a result in a natural and probable sequence and without which the result would not have occurred. A legal cause does not need to be the only cause of a result. A legal cause may act in combination with other causes to produce a result. And that's the state of the law. There is a general negligence instruction that was given. The negligence instruction was, negligence is the failure to use reasonable care. It is the doing of something which a reasonable person would not do, or the failure to do something that a reasonable person would do under facts similar to those shown by the evidence. The law does not say how a reasonable person would act under facts similar to those shown by the evidence. That is for you to decide. Breach of a duty owed to others or breach of a standard of care is negligence. That, in combination with the legal cause instruction, is the given state of the law. In answer to your question. Therefore, in light of the jury's finding, and again, I turn to the verdict form, and the verdict form very clearly laid out, one, was defendant negligence? The jury circled yes. The next inquiry, if the answer was yes, was the defendant's negligence the legal cause of Tim Burhan's injuries? The jury circles no. Okay, if no, the case is finished. Date and sign the verdict form, notify the bailiff. If you answered yes, then go on. And when you go on, you get to contributory negligence, you get to assumption of the risk and damages if appropriate. However, in this case, clearly the assumption of the risk and the contributory negligence affirmative defenses are never even reached by the jury's specific finding. That said,
not reached, but they are given. The jury's instructed on contributory negligence and assumption of the risk. And so if they have all this information, and if it's wrong, as Mr. Meyer-Henry urges, wouldn't that have an effect on the jury verdict? They have to go through it all, and then maybe they come back under your scenario where they consider just negligence and the legal cause. But, you know, they can't put that aside. And if those instructions were wrong, you know, and I'm not saying that they are, isn't that error for the trial court to give those instructions, even though there's a finding by the jury on legal cause?
I think, first of all, and as I've made clear, I disagree that that issue is raised in the jury's mind, because they don't get to that issue. So first of all, like I've said, they look to negligence, they look to legal cause, find it doesn't exist, and stop. So therefore, it's an aside. They don't even get to that issue. Secondly, and I can go into more detail on this now, but I firmly believe that both the assumption of the risk and the contributory negligence instruction were properly given, properly supported by the evidence, and that it was not error for them to be given. Thirdly, even if they were given in error, which you'd have to find that first they get to the instructions in their thinking, secondly that they were error, I don't believe it's prejudicial. There are several cases that stand for the precedent that you have to look at the jury instructions as a whole to decide whether or not, in light of all of them, there's a result that could change the jury's verdict in this regard. The Sommervold v. Grevelos case is instructive in that it states, only if it was inconsistent with substantial justice or affects a substantial right of a party is a jury instruction erroneous. Errors are not, the jury instructions must be construed as a whole to learn if they're provided a full and correct statement. The legal principles embodied in the proposed instructions were generally embodied in the instructions given by the trial court. As such, the trial court can properly and did properly refuse the requested instructions in that case. There's also case law stating the use of an unnecessary instruction does not rise to the level of prejudice if it represents a correct statement of the law and merely thoroughly outlines the specifics of the law. And that is taken from LDL Cattle Company, Inc. v. Gooder, again a South Dakota Supreme Court case from 1996. That case also said that this court has emphasized that the mere fact that instructions are somewhat duplicative or cumulative does not warrant a reversal of a verdict. Further, speculation that an issue has been unduly emphasized is simply not enough to meet the movement's burden as previously set forth by this court. The failure to establish prejudice on the record is a failure of the moving party to meet its burden. Therefore, the giving of instructions 22 and 23 in that case did not rise to the level of being prejudicial to LDL's case. On that subject, I do want to get back to the motion to amend that was made by Mr. Paul Lundberg, the attorney for Dennis Supply. As stated in the brief, it was filed before the trial date. There was not time on the court's calendar to hear it. Until then, defense counsel laid out in his affidavit the specifics in terms of the request for the instruction. He had pled contributory negligence from the start. The several factors that I outlined, standing up in the moving boat, not wearing the life preserver, and throwing the seat cushion, all three things were discovered and or secured through discovery. Also through discovery, it was made known that Tim Burhan had a boat, had a cabin, used it on weekends during the summer, was very familiar with all types of issues around being around boats. He went out and fished on his own. He took his family up there during the summers. That came out during discovery, and the same issues that had supported the contributory negligence affirmative defense also support the assumption of the risk defense in combination with his knowledge. Therefore, it was not a surprise, and there were not new techniques argued by defense counsel at trial. Rather, it was the evidence that had come out through discovery and the evidence that had originally been used to plead contributory negligence.
As a factual matter, were there straps on the seat cushion?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Is there a picture of the seat cushion in the file?
I don't have a picture of the seat cushion in my file. I don't, and I'm not sure if Mr. Meyer Henry would. Further, taking the position that I've taken that we're not even getting to the assumption of the risk argument because of the negligence but no proximate cause argument, there are three cases that this court has decided in 2001 and 2002 where assumption of the risk and contributory negligence instructions have been given. Again, there are many issues that are outlined in Mr. Meyer Henry's brief, and I have responded to all of them in my brief, and I would just again instruct the court to look to the further explanations in the brief. However, one of the big claims of Mr. Meyer Henry and the appellant, Tim Burhan, is that assumption of the risk is not a valid defense in this state following the 1998 amendment to 20-9-2. And again, if the reasoning of the court gets to this point, there is three cases that the court would have to fly in the direct face of in order to hold contrary to the fact that assumption of the risk is a valid instruction and a valid defense, and that both assumption of the risk and contributory negligence can be given in a matter as a matter of law in the state. First case is Busker v. Thuringer. It was decided July of 2002, and in that case, both contributory negligence and assumption of the risk were given, and further, they were both given with the old language in the instructions previous to the amendment. The court holding that the amendment actually just modernized the language, simplified the statute, and there was no prejudice from using the old instructions. Therefore, I think that case also supports the fact that the jury instructions were not perfectly given. However, they were not given to a level where any error prejudiced the result of the jury. Secondly, the case of Parker v. Casa del Rey, Rapid City, decided in February of 2002, upheld an assumption of risk instruction on appeal. And that case specifies assumption of the risk exists under the precedent of the state, and it specifically states that, again, saying that it's a judge-made law. In the case of Rand Tappa v. Black Hills Chair Lift Company, a 2001 South Dakota Supreme Court case, there was actually a more specific duty instruction that was given, which was reversed upon, being that it conflicted with general negligence, and also, that case states, again, very clearly that assumption of the risk is an affirmative defense, and it is a 2001 case. So those three cases very strongly support the premise that assumption of the risk is alive as an affirmative defense in the state post the 1998 amendment that was made to our comparative negligence statute. And I do want to point out, too, that the comparative negligence statute, as we have it defined in this state, is very clearly a hybrid form of comparative negligence. It is not the same as a pure comparative negligence statute. We specifically have the wording slight in our statute, and our statute specifically states that if the plaintiff's negligence is more than slight, he or she is not allowed to recover. Our statute is very specifically modeled after the Nebraska statute, which has also retained the defense of assumption of the risk. Therefore, in looking to the law of our state and in looking to the law of the state of Nebraska upon which our statute was adopted, it very clearly supports the idea that assumption of the risk is still a valid defense. Further, I want to point out that Mr. Meyer-Henry for Tim Burhan spins or puts forth his idea of what the jury's finding of legal cause was, what the finding or the basis of assumption of the risk is. But again, we don't know for sure what the jury found in those regards, and we can only give an opinion on that ground.
Can I ask a question then on that? The jury found, indisputably, didn't it, that the person running the boat did something wrong with the tiller. They found that he was negligent, right?
Something wrong in some regard, anyway.
All right, so I'm having trouble with what you said about the fact that the decedent was standing up in the boat at the time being the legal cause. or not wearing a life jacket being the legal cause. Can you clarify what you mean by that? How could that be if the operator of the boat is negligent by doing something wrong with the tiller? How can you say that standing up in the boat was the legal cause of the injury?
What I did was advance several different ways that I think the jury could have found. I think the jury could have found the fact that if he stood up, that somehow would have contributed to being the legal cause if he wasn't wearing the life jacket. But I think the strongest argument is that he was in the water, he had the flotation seat device, and he voluntarily chose to give it up. I think that's the strongest of the three. I don't believe that there are any issues that the plaintiff raises in his brief that could change the result of the trial. And I remind the court that it needs to apply the most favorable, it needs to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to uphold the jury verdict. I also think that it's fairly significant that appellant did not raise an issue with a fact finding by the jury of proximate cause. That is never raised as an issue in the brief, and nor is the verdict form. So that verdict supporting the negligence and the no proximate cause is not raised, nor is the verdict form.
Out of curiosity, whose verdict form is this? Was it proposed by the defense or by the plaintiff?
I don't know for sure. It may have been by the court.
Okay.
Both submitted legal issues. Further, I just want to point out that the court does not weigh the evidence and does not substitute its judgment for that of the jury, and that's coming from Nelson v. Nelson Cattle Company in 1994, South Dakota Supreme Court. These functions lie solely within the province of the jury. Contributory negligence and proximate cause can only be decided by the court when the facts are not in dispute or such that reasonable men could not differ. Raybell v. Fisher's Grove Golf Course, Inc., South Dakota, 1974 case. And further, in closing, I would like to say I quoted a quote from Louis Menand, the Metaphysical Club, that said, in a modern society, we know an outcome is right, or that a claim that a particular state of affairs is legitimate not because it was derived from immutable principles, but because it was reached by following the correct procedures. The modern conception of the law is similar. If the legal process was adhered to, the outcome is just. Justice does not pre-exist the case at hand. Justice is whatever result just procedures have led to.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
No, I just have one question. We deferred your motion to strike the reply brief. What's that? Just real briefly.
In appellant's brief, reply brief, he brings up the issue of the jury's finding of proximate cause.
Okay.
He did not bring that up in his original brief, and therefore it was untimely brought up in the rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer Henry, you have 10 minutes, sir.
I would like to read to the court from page 51, which is the final argument of Mr. Lindberg, very quickly, because it synopsizes why there was some prejudice by giving the assumption of the risk instruction that cannot be eliminated in a case like this. The question is given, Mr. Burhan's own knowledge and experience, is it the defendant's fault that he didn't choose to put one on? Life vest. Undeniable, undisputed evidence in this case that Mr. Burhan had extensive experience in boats and knowledge about boats and had been fishing all over the Midwest and Canada in boats. His father told us Tim would not need anyone to tell him when to put a life jacket on. He could assess the weather and the water conditions and the type of boat he was in and who's operating it. He could make his own judgment. And if that's what you find in this case, then the plaintiff can't win. Because if they're saying on one hand he should have a life jacket on because this was a business trip, if he didn't have it on because he made a conscious decision not to, even though he had experience and knowledge and judgment and opportunity to make that decision, then he assumed the risk and plaintiffs can't win. So he mixes contributory negligence, duty, and assumption of the risk in that one paragraph. The court refused to instruct on duties of the parties. That's the circuit court's prerogative and duty. The judge below refused to instruct on whether a person is required to wear a life jacket. No case says so, and most say no. The other thing that was brought up in questioning of my worthy opponent is she now, we wouldn't know that because Judge Sirska refused to accept our instructions, proposed instructions, which set forth even on the contributory negligence instruction. And this is kind of like the Johnson versus Armstead case that you recently decided. We don't know what is going to be argued in final argument if the circuit court will not, first of all, define the risk in instructions. We don't know here. It allowed the defense throughout the case to expand this risk, expand the risk. That lets in evidence. It lets in types of evidence that certainly affect the jury. So number one, before we even get to that, how can you have a proper legal cause decision if you don't have the proper duties of the respective parties? But now, for the first time, and I tried the case, we find out what the defendant believes could have been the legal cause of this accident. When two people are thrown into the water by the negligence of one, and as the evidence showed below, the negligent agent of Dennis Supply hollered in the water, at least this is what he told the wife, he couldn't swim. The dead man, who is a powerful swimmer, gives up the cushion. That's the legal cause. I mean, this is after the fact. Well, assumption of the risk, they argued it was also assumption of the risk. So if it was to me it's more assumption of the risk than it is contributory negligence. But having pitched them into frigid water, that would be a finding of legal cause? Ms. Nicholson read to you what legal cause is. If they were pitched in the water, how could the jury not find it was the legal cause or a contributing legal cause?
Well, doesn't it go to is you assume or you state that they're pitched in the water because the driver turned the tiller. As I recall the facts from the brief, it seemed more likely, and it seemed that DeGroote even denied that he turned the tiller, causing the boat to go sideways before Burhan stood up on a slippery bottom of the boat while it was raining. And I thought DeGroote took the position that Burhan standing up caused the boat to tip, which caused then him to start to lose his balance, and that's what caused the tiller to go sideways.
Exactly. That is correct. But here's my point I'm trying to make. In instruction 23, the jury was told, in this action, plaintiff has the burden of proving the following issues. One, Tom DeGroote was negligent in his operation of the boat on September 12, 1999. Those facts that you rendered, if they found for the defendant on that issue, they wouldn't have found that he was negligent in his operation of the boat on September 12, 1999.
Well, he can be negligent in not attaching the lanyard. But that's something that comes into play after the fact that people have fallen out of the boat. I mean, his negligence isn't confined to pulling the tiller to the side and causing the boat. I mean, it seems to me that his negligence is an after the fact thing of not attaching the lanyard.
Well, but recalling Your Honor, one of the cases you wrote about the seat belt case, his not having the lanyard occurred after his negligence. That was a safety device that would have saved these gentlemen had he used it. But it doesn't go to the negligent act. It's an additional negligent act. The jury found that he was negligent in his operation of the boat, ergo the people were pitched out. Now, once in the water, had he had a lanyard on, the boat would have stopped. And we can only surmise, since the testimony is my client swam 100, client's husband swam 150 yards in this water before he drowned, that he could have gotten 20, 25 yards back to the boat and they would have survived. But that's an after the fact matter. You know, throughout my appeal, I have argued that in these instructions, slight that they are, the court refused. When you get to contributory, well, let me read the rest of it. It goes to the heart part of the appeal. The defendant has the burden of proving these issues. Tim Burhan was contributorily negligent. There is nowhere in the instructions a duty. And that's what this court, and I was happy to see it, just decided in that case where the guy pulled out and said she must have been speeding. We've got to look at these defenses the same way up here. No judge would instruct that the defendant was negligent. Make up your duties. No. Number one, negligent in the operation of the boat. But we go down to what they had to prove. The defendant assumed the risk. Tim Burhan was contributorily negligent, yet gave no duty instructions. Is it negligent to stand up in a boat? Are they alleging that? They argued it. It's not in the instructions. We don't have a finding. We just got whatever they wanted to argue, and they did. An assumption of the risk. What risk? What risk? We don't know today. He argued five or six of them. Which ones are legally sufficient? I claim none. I had an opportunity to object to none. Judge Sirska wouldn't listen. That you, if you're going to be contributorily negligent, you have to violate a duty. What duty did he violate? And it's a, we've got this general duty to take care of themselves. But what's the duty of a boat passenger? Whether you, whatever you find will be the duty of a boat passenger. I think it's a case of first impression here. But is it the duty of a boat passenger not to stand up or whatever? Once again, these are things the court has to instruct so that when we get the legal cause here, he argues, as I read to you, you can kind of just, if you don't, if you just think it's wrong that some guy's fishing with his buddies can sue some guy that dumps you in the water and drowns you, well, then you can make up your defenses. You can say he assumed the risk. And these two are so closely related that they have an effect. I mean, he argues throughout, you assumed the risk of going fishing, basically. That's not the law in South Dakota. Let's go to hunting. We've had hunting cases. You don't assume the risk of going hunting with a group. No case holds that. And yet that was the essence of the final argument in this case. This was just a fishing trip. I mean, there's some remarks that, you know, this is a artificial area here. We're talking about an artificial area. The argument is about legal cause and all of this is if you don't have proper instructions on the duties, how can the jury make a proper determination on what the legal cause was? Even if this case would have gotten down to contributory negligence, which I couldn't argue because I didn't know, no one knows, exactly what they're arguing breached the plaintiff's duty to the defendant. That's a legal argument, and you can't object in final argument with these broad brush, knew or should have known, common man. When we try a lawsuit, if the defense does in fact have a defense, because as you said in this recent case, which was decided after this one, was the negligence of the defendant or of the plaintiff the legal cause? Judge Sirska didn't even get to that level. He wouldn't get to the primary level of tell us if we are contributory or comparative negligence, what acts violated the duty of a boat passenger?
Your time has expired.
Thank you. I urge you to reverse this case for the numerous errors of the circuit.
We recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.